Welcome, everyone. Oh, we're going to have loud voice issues again. We would like to start with the Pledge of Allegiance. If you could please stand and join me for the pledge. Ready? Begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. And before we get started, we did want to take just a brief moment of silence in memory of those who passed away in 9/11, 24 years ago. Thank you. We also want to take a moment to acknowledge the heaviness that many of us are feeling, as yesterday, a political rally in Utah turned violent, ultimately taking the life of Charlie Kirk. That event was closely followed by a school shooting in Denver. And it is moments like these that are painful reminders that violence has no place in our politics, in our schools, or in our communities. We know that we all come from different viewpoints, different faiths, different histories, and different backgrounds. Those differences matter because they shape how we see the world. But in spite of those differences, what unites us is something just as important: our commitment to showing up, to listening, and to talking through our challenges with respect. I want to thank each of you for being here tonight and for choosing to have a conversation instead of conflict. Your actions are helping to move Idaho forward towards a peaceful, just, and thriving state of civility. As we process the weight of what happened yesterday and what happened historically today, let us choose to move forward together as Idahoans with respect for one another. My name is Marcy Kerr. I have been actively involved in the speech and debate community for over 30 years and have been an educator in Eastern Idaho for 17 years. This event is hosted by Save Our Schools. Founded by retired veteran public school champions, Save Our Schools Idaho is dedicated to providing information, data, and education to people about how vouchers and their efforts to divert public tax dollars and private tuition impact our local schools. Tonight, we hope to answer your questions about the recently passed private school tuition voucher bill that Governor Little signed into law this legislative session. We will give an overview of the impacts of that legislation, introduce our panelists, and then we will take questions from the audience. Our goal is for everyone to leave this room with a better understanding of the impact that vouchers have on our communities and what actions we can take to make our voices heard. So as a matter of definitions, we'd like to start this panel by defining vouchers as an umbrella term that we're using for any government program that takes taxpayer dollars and funnels them to private or private religious schools. So vouchers can come in the form of tax credits, education savings accounts, or a number of other means. Just months ago, our lawmakers passed House Bill 93, which created a $50 million voucher program for private religious school students up to $5,000, or in the case of special needs students, $7,500, to cover tuition and other educational expenses. This means that for the first time in Idaho's history, our tax dollars are now going to private school tuition. HB 93 is a tax credit voucher, which means that the recipients can claim the credit on their taxes. It is not capped per household, and families can receive more than what they paid in for their taxes that year. For example, if we assume that an Idaho family of four with two school-aged children earns $96,000 a year, that is three times the poverty level, they would receive $5,000 per student. After the Idaho standard deductions, that family would be paying about $3,800 towards income tax. And even though they pay only $3,800 in income tax, they will get a full $10,000 back, meaning the other $6,200 of that will come from the State General Fund, which is funded by Idaho taxpayers. So this is not just a matter of families taking their dollars to another school of choice. They're taking all of our dollars with them. Additionally, this voucher program will be administered through the Idaho Tax Commission. They do not administer any other educational program. if you look at your Idaho revenue flow, the other thing that this means is that the funding for this voucher legislation comes out of the income credits box, meaning it comes out before legislators are given the ability to appropriate funding. It comes out before any other program. It's like you having a deduction taken out of your paycheck. You're not only going to have less money for groceries, you're going to have less money for gas and all of your other bills. It impacts everything in our state. As our legislators come back in to negotiate this year, their budget is $50 million less than it was last year because this money comes out first. Concerningly, in other states, similar tax credits have been used to pay for Lego sets, trips to Disneyland, and other non-educated related expenses without repercussions because of the lack of accountability built into the structure. While recipients are theoretically required to show proof of expenses that they use the tax credit for, they are only held accountable if they are audited. And right now, fewer than 2% of tax returns in Idaho are being audited. Most importantly, during public hearings and testimonies, the testimony on House Bill 93 was opposed to this legislation at a factor of 20-1. 73 of our superintendents signed a letter in opposition, and the week before the governor's decision to sign this legislation, 37,000 Idahoans called into his office with an overwhelming request that he veto. Proponents of House Bill 93 have already begun to work on expanding this bill to over $300 million in the next legislative session. This would have a significant impact not only on Idaho's budget, but on our taxes as well. It is important to note that private schools and homeschools are an important part of our educational system, and they existed prior to this legislation. The concerns that we have about House Bill 93 that we are discussing are not an attack on those educational options. Let's go ahead and introduce our panelists. On our panel today, we have Jan Baer. Jan is a superintendent of Boundary County School District. Jan's extensive experience includes serving as a principal at Kellogg Middle School and as the director of curriculum, instruction, assessment, professional development, and federal programs for both Kellogg and Wallace School Districts. Jan lives in Bonner Ferry with her husband. Kim Keaton, is a capacity builder for Idaho Building Capacity Project. He facilitates North Idaho education systems by supporting school administrators and leadership teams with the ability to experience and understand the best practices for our Idaho student population. Prior to joining IBC 10 years ago, he was the principal of Sandpoint Middle School. He was thoroughly involved and committed to Lake Pend Oriel School District,
Lake Ponderay.
Oh my gosh, that's how you spell Ponderé? Love you all. I'm from Pocatello. I grew up in Ammon, and my mom's here, so you can blame her. She was even one of my teachers. Sorry, Lake Ponderé School District. School District's cutting edge years and systems change, educational evaluation, instructional coaching, scientifically based curriculum, and data utilization. Elizabeth Wargo researches leadership and policy associated with educational improvement in remote locations. She has led and supported extensive work with schools, government, and companies on all continents except Antarctica. She leads several projects that directly support rural schools and districts across the state, and they sustainably evolve and support the health of communities that they serve. In her free time, she enjoys playing in the mountains of northern Idaho with her tall husband, teen daughter, and Aussie Shepherd Tucker. And with that, I would like to invite each of our panelists to give their opening remarks. Jan, would you like to get us started?
Thank you for the invitation to be here this evening. It's an honor to speak on behalf of our district and our community. One thing I did state when they asked me to be here, I said I can speak on factual terms and how it's going to impact our school district, but I won't give my own personal opinions on this matter. I do like to say and communicate that we do have our mission that we want to educate and empower all students to become lifelong learners and contributing members of society. And it, we had a committee of about 40 individuals that made that mission statement for our district. And why we said that is we want our children or our students to grow up and give back to their communities. It's okay to be productive and be citizens and be able to earn their way in life, but we want them to also give back. And so I feel this is one way I can give back to this cause. I have an amazing board that supports us in our measures. Our vice chair is out here watching this evening to ensure that I represent us well. Like the intro said, I was born and raised in North Idaho. Actually, I was born in the Sandpoint Hospital, so I'm sad that no other children will be born there. But yes, born and raised, I taught in Bonners Ferry as a special education teacher, general education teacher, went on to be the curriculum director. Like she said, worked in Kellogg and Wallace, and I'm currently in my seventh year as a superintendent. Believe in continuous improvement. I believe all kids can learn at high levels. And I want to communicate, I'm not opposed at all to parent choice. It's just very difficult when we have to go out and beg the public for a supplemental levy and a bond, and we can't hardly pass those, that we continue then to fight an uphill battle and funds are diverted. Fulfill your constitutional obligation and fund public education to the level they need to be funded, and then once that's accomplished, I don't mind those funds being diverted.
You have Citizen Liz here tonight. I lay my head on my pillow tonight, like every night in Bonner County. I have a daughter that's at SMS right now. And you know, you mentioned families might get extra dollars out of this whole thing. I think the main reason why I'm here tonight is because the side of myself professionally, which again, I'm a citizen tonight here. I'm a mom and a fierce advocate for the types of education that our communities deserve. But I am a professor at the University of Idaho as well. So I get paid to think and discuss and research what's best practice and pay attention to what's happening related to education all over the country. And I'll tell you this, an enormous amount of money is going to for-profit companies, most of which are nowhere near Idaho, in ways that don't benefit kids. Those dollars are your tax dollars. And so that's probably the main why that I'm here tonight, is I don't frankly believe that that's what's going to be best for our communities in the Idaho Panhandle specifically. Second, I really look forward to digging in, hearing your amazing questions, having some good discourse tonight about this. It's important. It's vitally important that we understand the complex reality that we face when we think about facilitating awesome teaching and learning for all kids in North Idaho. It's vitally important that we understand the complexities so that we can stay ahead of it. And again, prevent some of these dollars from going out of state. Finally, I get the pleasure of being the nerd that sees behind the scenes and sees the Boundary County School District and LPUSD and all sorts of other, many, many other districts in North Idaho are absolutely rocking it. I think my middle school daughter would probably say, slaying it? But the reality is that they outperform the state and the national average year after year after year. They do that despite insanely wicked challenges. They do that for every student, every day. That's the value of public education. That's the value of what our communities, when I think 20 years in the future, absolutely deserve.
These are two tough acts to follow. I'm Kim Keaton, born and raised here in Sandpoint, and I'm going to talk and paint a picture of what rural schools are in North Idaho and how we differ from these urban schools, the challenges we have with urban schools. And the other thing I want to tell you about is my opportunity I've had in my career being an educator at Sandpoint Middle School, had a great staff here. I see a couple of them here tonight. Thank you for coming. And I want to thank everybody for coming and spending the evening with us. But, you know, what I really want to talk about is that I've had an opportunity to be in every school and work with every district in Boundary County and Bonner County. I worked with West Bonner County School District. I worked with Jan up at Boundary County. I worked, obviously, LPOSD, Lake Pontchartrain School District. It's been a pleasure. But you get a sense of what rural is when you live up here. You get a sense of what community is when you live up here. How many people have been to a harvest dinner? Raise your hand. Ever been to a harvest dinner? And who do you see at a harvest dinner? Everybody in that community. Everybody. I remember taking my mom and dad to Northside. Well, I didn't go to Northside School, but we went there. They just talked their ears off to everybody there. It was just fun. Ever been to school choir play at night or something? If you've been there, you know, it brings out the whole community. It brings out grandparents. And so rural, we think of rural, and we think, oh, those are rural schools because, you know, they're lacking in size. No, they're community schools. They represent their community. I was at the fair this year, and I saw kids from Northside. They ride horses. They have cattle. You know, you can see it. They're part of that. So I'm going to talk about the challenges we have with rural schools because they are real, and the impact of this private schooling, funding private schooling, it's real. And we're going to also talk about. I'm going to spend some time talking about not only the challenges we have because we're small. That urban schools, I don't even think realize exist when they talk about us, because I don't know how many hats Jan wears, but there's so many hats. You've got title funds, you've got all these sorts of things that you have to do. So tonight I really want to have a sense of what community is, a sense of what rural is, and then I want to attack that, what we're doing at the state legislature, the state house, and see if we can make some changes. So anyway, thanks again for coming. I appreciate it.
Thank you all for your introductions. We're going to jump into a couple of pre-submitted questions. The first one, public schools have accountability with test scores, student enrollment, and local elected school boards that review their budgets publicly. Jan, what guardrails are in place to ensure that private school voucher tax credits are being used to put taxpayer dollars to appropriate use?
Actually, I was in the Senate chambers when they were discussing what those accountability measures would be. And the only thing that really has come out is that they'll have a parent satisfaction survey. Compared to public schools, where at board meetings we have to do everything in open public meetings, we have to follow state standards, we have background checks for our employees, we take standardized testing, we submit continuous improvement plans. So at this point in time, when you look at the law, you can Google it, you can AI it, and they say that there are some accountability measures, but what comes out of that is a portfolio for growth. As a public school educator, I'd love to be able to show our growth through portfolios because so much learning happens that can't be reflected on a standardized test, but that isn't an option for us. They say that there's financial liability for misuse of funds, yet you said it in your opening statement, only 2% of tax returns are audited in the state of Idaho. They said that they have to report to the tax commission. We know the tax commission is not really prepared for what will be required of them. And they say they have to have their expenses documented, which is great. We do too as public entities, but we also have to go through annual audits, and then we have to post everything we spend online. So the accountability measures are not the same.
Liz, are there any protections that will ensure that this legislation is not funneling taxpayer dollars outside of Idaho?
I'm going to be professional. No. And I think it's something like 2% the tax commission audits. So say they're going to audit. I can't for the life of me think of how a state tax auditor would know the first thing about being able to evaluate whether a early literacy program that somebody has bought online is worth a darn. I don't know. I mean, maybe they are. I don't mean to dismiss them. Or how maybe a STEM program that somebody bought online or a virtual something or other. You're going to hear me later talk about Florida a little bit and the debacle that's going on there. But in short, not that I really know. I can't imagine how that would work out. I mean, that's like a challenge that I give to the tax commission to become really informed about what it takes to provide high quality education. But my guess is they have other things they need to do.
Is there anything in the legislation that requires those dollars to be spent in state?
No, and that is also an interesting aspect, although it's a bit of a maybe a bird walk for what we're centered on tonight. The reality is that LPOSD in Bonner County, West Bonner County School Districts, Coeur d'Alene School District, all of our districts, basically except maybe outside of the Treasure Valley with Micron and others, are some of the largest employers in the areas. And if you think about that, there is an enormous impact that they have on our communities. They live here, they spend their tax dollars here. So in a way, we've got a closed system. Those folks are working hard for you, for each kid every day, no matter what, all kids, right? They have to take all kids to do the thing that they're accountable for and they're prepared for and they're well supported for. The others, it's like the wild, wild online global, not West, globe, right? In terms of where the dollars might possibly go. And I'll tell you what, take a guess at what the ed tech industry is valued at right now. Does anybody have an idea? Take a stab. Well, I looked it up today. Of course, it's always ever-changing, but it's $300+ billion. It's a huge industry, right? If you don't think that folks are trying to capitalize now, knowing that that money is potentially there, you're wrong.
Okay, our next question. Sponsors of Idaho's first voucher bill capped it at $50 million. As soon as it passed, one of the advocates said that $50 million will become $250 million in the blink of an eye. Kim, could this expansion happen in Idaho, and how would that expansion affect Idaho taxpayers and public schools? Could you also elaborate on how less money being allocated to North Idaho schools would affect our classrooms and our local taxes?
Well, that's a great question. Let's talk about rural schools again. So Idaho has an interesting funding formula. One size fits all. We're a diverse state, but if you look at how we're funded, it's a simple formula. Well, in Idaho, when we look at our rural schools, we don't have every school's not 450 kids. Every elementary school is 450 kids. And so when you look at 450 kids, that gets you a principal, that gets your teachers. That's an urban school. That's an urban look school. That's not the case at Mount Hall, our northernmost school. That's not the case at Priest Lake Elementary. I got about 80 kids there. So there's a big discretion. That's called the economy of scale. So what we do in these big urban districts that we have, and we have more than you think in Idaho, our little rural districts, we don't have 23 kids in every classroom at middle school. You know, we don't have, and that's what the perfect formula has. The perfect formula for a first grader is 18. We don't have 18 in every first grade class. So how do you make up the difference? It's pretty obvious. You have to make up the difference with levies. Because the question is, why do we want our rural schools? They're community schools. Why are they there? Because we don't want kindergartners driving 45 minutes on the bus. We're spread out everywhere. And they have to be there. We serve that community. We serve that community school. So that's the first strike against us. The other strike against us is that we're small and certain things happen. Special ed kids come in with high needs. We serve them all. Matter of fact, the state, we asked for $82 million from the state. We got zero. We got a $50 million voucher program. So that comes again out of our pockets. Who pays for that? Well, we do it through levies. In areas that don't have the income, the urban areas do. I've got two legislators standing in the back that I'm beating on constantly about this. Thanks for Mark and Jim, Mark Sauter and Jim Ward for coming. We need to have another funding formula that helps rural Idaho. We just cannot have the one size fits all. The other thing is this huge outside interest that just got us all by surprise about 8 years ago. We're all rural. We just think rural. We don't realize tons of money is going to come in our area. And I always say this, you know, if you talk like a Republican, walk like a Republican, you're probably a Republican. If you talk like a Democrat, walk like a Democrat, you're probably a Democrat. If you take outside money and just do whatever they tell you, you're a politician. And those are the worst kind of people we want in helping us. We want our legislatures to look at our issues. That doesn't happen. The legislatures also did a terrible job budgeting this year. They missed the mark so fast and so hard, I can't believe it. They overspent. We're supposed to be a conservative state, they overspent. That's hurting us. Those are the kind of things that is part of our issues right now. But we also, if we lose kids, and it can just be a handful, and you're a small district, it can be a handful of small schools, we have fixed school costs. Our schools, we have to heat them, our buses have got to get them there, we have to keep the lights on. Those are the things that we struggle with because we're this rural school. So the private school, when we look at, we're already getting taxed more, and now we're going to pay through income tax more to support private schools because they're going to be basically in Boise because that's where the private schools are at. They're going to be again in our urban areas, and we're going to be paying out of our pocket income tax. So we get levied, we pay income tax. That's a double-edged sword that we just can't afford, and that's what's coming against it. By the way, I'm all for homeschools. We've got great friends that homeschool their kids, and all for private schools. I've got a lot of friends that do private schools. I'm not against that at all. I'm against funding private schools. Thank you.
Thank you, Kim. You clarified some things like not having 18 first graders in all of your elementary school classes because you're so spread apart out here. And I just want to, as we ask Jan the next question, we're going to reference back to that family of four that we talked about in the introduction, who's taking $10,000 to go educate their kids online or somewhere else. According to my understanding, that would remove $18,000 from a school district up here, correct? Removing two kids at about if we pulled two kids out of this district at $9,000 a kid, it's gonna remove that much money from the school. Can you explain how our schools are funded and how losing that kind of money impacts our fixed costs and our fixed budgets?
So essentially we have three pots of money. We have federal, state, and local funds. Our federal funds are generated primarily through our title programs. For us, we have secure rural school funding because so much of our property is owned by the federal government. And then we have just various allocations. So we have to plan for those. For example, this last year, we were counting on about $800,000 in federal funding. We budgeted, we wrote plans, and they told us June 30th, don't count on it. And you've already signed contracts, so those are some fixed costs that were already in place. Luckily, we did weather that storm. We are funded for that. But that's an example of a federal fund that we depend on. We have state funding. State funding to school districts, you have average daily attendance. So your enrollment might be, say, 1,500, but only 1,400 kids show up on a day. So you're losing hundreds of dollars a day. And the concern for that is we do have fixed costs. We run 5 buildings. We bus over 700 miles a day, whether one kid's absent or not. We have electricity, we have water, we have textbooks, we have desks. And when the students don't show up, it doesn't mean our costs go away. The other concern with that is we're required to educate them whether they're in the building or not. So there's hours upon hours of instruction that occur above the school day, and then interventions often if they aren't in school. So those fixed costs are still there. So average daily attendance is how we're primarily funded, and then we have what's called special distributions, but it usually is always tied back to your best 28 weeks of attendance or your overall best 10 weeks. And so it's really a struggle. So we do the very best with the information we have at the time to construct those budgets, and then we adjust through the year. And then we have our local funds. Boundary County's been very, I would say, conservative, but we still serve our students well. We have not increased our supplemental maintenance and operation levy over the last 10 years. It's remained at 2.4%. It's dropped from 23% of our budget to almost 12% of our overall budget, and we're proud of that. But our big concern is if we continue to see reduced funding from the state, or that's actually stated wrong. We still receive more funding, but it's not keeping up with the pace of inflation and what it costs to run our facilities. So you'll hear all the time, well, you know what, they got this increase, and in the last 5 years, we've gone up 50%. Yeah, I'm sure your electric bill has too in your home. So it's not really giving us more money to function as a school district. So just in summary, we have federal funds, state funds, local funds. When there's changes in those state funds, it ultimately or has shown to go back to local dollars through levies. That's very consistent if you look at the patterns when we had the recession in 2008, and you see the amount of the increase in levies across the state, those supplemental levies, they significantly increase. So it's really just in a shift of who's paying for those. The schools, it's not really, you're still paying, you're almost paying more.
Thank you. On to our last question. Supporters of this bill have messaged this as a win for school choice, while opponents have said that this is wealth redistribution that provides government subsidies with minimal accountability and zero transparency. Kim, did we have school choice before this bill was passed?
Do we ever have school choice? We've got a lot of school choice. I'm just going to, again, talk. Let's talk about up here in rural Idaho, northern rural Idaho. We have four high schools in this district. One is at Clark Fork. I was out at Clark Fork last year talking to Phil Kemmick. And he's got a workforce training program out there. He does online learning out there. He's told me one of the workforce training is when juniors and seniors can do an elective during school, the last one or two periods, and get an elective for that. And we don't care if they get paid or not. That's none of our business, but that's what happens. And he was telling me this story about this girl that wanted to be a house cleaner. Okay. And they said, oh, that's workforce training. We got Hope Hotels. We'll get you there. She came back at the end of the semester, and she wanted to run her own house cleaning business. I thought that was just great. He does online. Then you go to a really comprehensive high school here. You know, CTE programs, building a new CTE building. You've got high academics. You've got everything in place in our high school here for kids to do. I went to the high school last year, too, just to kind of talk to the principal that's a friend of ours. And there was a kid in back that I knew. As a matter of fact, he's a graduate of some of these people I see out here, Josh Radigan. And he just said, hey, come back and look at this little house we're building. They were building a little house. Their construction department was building a little house for somebody to eventually buy. I mean, we do everything. We've got a great alternative school here. I look at their alternative. Not all kids are raised the same. And we need to realize that. Some kids get more breaks than other kids. They don't have the support of a family, or they do have the support of a family, and it's not the quality of support they need. So we've got a wonderful alternative school here. We also have a charter school here. The charter school was formed because they wanted to offer project-based learning. And so you create a project, you work on it for 6 weeks, and you'll learn all the essential standards. Tons there. I was up in Jan's school district at Naples this last year, and I was talking to the principal up there, a great lady. I guess what they're doing, they've got a homeschool academy. We have a lot of homeschool parents. We think it's important. Are they part of our community? Yes, they are. Is it important that we help them? Yes, it is. I believe strongly in that. So there's a homeschool academy up there. I think she told me I had 400 kids. I like that idea so much, I brought it to West Bonner County School District. They have 75 this year. Their parents are out there, they care for their kids. We don't care if you teach religion. We've got a curriculum for you. You can teach religion on your own time. That's what you want to do. We strongly believe in difference between religious state and religion. We believe they need to be separate. But we're going to do some activities with them, once a month activities. Tons of choice. I worked at Bridge Academy. It's an online school. It's all the kids that didn't make it to alternative school have one last stop. I call it the backstop of alternative schools. Great school there. They have the largest graduation class. They graduate at 21. You get them at 16, they spend 5 years, but they've got a degree, and they can either do it online or there. We try to make it whatever it takes for you to get a high school degree. So do we have choice? Have we created more choice with private schools? They already existed. They're not the choice that we think of, how we've made choice. They're there. They're just going to get tax money. One of my big concerns is we have excellent special ed programs in the northern spot. And I just want to end on that. They probably won't take these kids. They're going to get a little bit of extra money. But when you look at these kids that we have, they're life skills kids, and we're just teaching them how to get by for the rest of life. And they're wonderful parents, and they're wonderful kids. They cost a lot of money. They cost a lot of money to educate.
Thank you, Tim.
Not $7,500. They're cutting me off.
Cutting you off.
Everybody knew it that knows me out there knew they'd be cutting me off, so thanks.
You used your 2 minutes and Liz's. So with that, we're going to go ahead and open up for questions from the audience. If you have questions for our panelists, please line up at the microphone stand in the center aisle. We'll be limiting our questions to 2 minutes. After 2 minutes, we will turn the questions over to the panelists for an answer. So if you have questions for our panelists.
I'm not shy. Jason Funk, I have 7 kids, okay, 2 marriages. I have 3 left in school. The majority of my kids are above average achievers. I'm going to talk about my youngest, Sarah. She's 7 years old and is being forced to be in first grade because she missed the cutoff by a couple of days. She's currently reading at a third grade reading level and doing math at a fifth grade reading level. If I were to take my child to a private school, then I could advance her at her ability versus being forced to be in a public school setting and being forced to be at the regulations of the school district. One size fits all. One size does not fit all. My question is, would it not be more beneficial if we took every child, gave them all individual money, and then let them be able to choose whether we can go to private school, public school, homeschool, online school, and advance at their own level? Because when I think about private schools, I think about high-achieving kids, and that's where all the high-achieving kids come out of.
As a clarifying question, would you put that flat rate per student at the flat rate that's paid to the district, or the flat rate that exists for the state, or the flat rate that is the tuition for the private schools? So BK is $10,000. They're a big private school in Boise area. Boise area schools get about $8,000 per student. this tax voucher gives $5,000 per student. Where would you see that money distribution coming out as?
Well, the schools get, what, $9,000 per student per year?
On average.
So, I mean, that's a much more difficult question, because if we took out, let's just call it $10,000 per student across the state. It doesn't matter the dollar amount, but if we gave each student, each child, a specific dollar amount and let free market choose where schools go or where the dollars are spent, would that not be a more fair way to allocate the tax dollars?
Kim.
First, I am so grateful that you care about the education of your children. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, not all kids have an advocate like you. Number one.
How many parents are okay. here?
Number two, the thing that I worry about the most with something like that is not folks like yourself. It's folks that are not as articulate as yourself, not the advocate that I can tell you are for your child. And I'll tell you this, that in the free market, you're going to get a lot of choices. You have a lot of choices right now. Cutting through what are quality choices that will actually do what you think and what you deserve and what your child deserves is a total other story. That's what worries me about this more than anything. Not the idea that we as individuals, remember I opened, I'm a parent, I want what's best for my daughter. I know that you want what's best for your daughter. But the reality is that $300 billion ed tech industry, there is a huge portion of that does not care. And without accountability and transparency, we're going to get taken. It's pretty simple like this. Say we all show up at a farmer's market tomorrow. Instead of the, what are there, like, we have actually a lot. Like four amazing bread bakers in our community that all bake real good bread, right? All of a sudden, there's 10,000, many of which we've never seen before. And it's a complete open market. Sweet. We all have $10 to buy for our bread. You buy bread because there's a fancy stand and a good design and a great salesperson that listens to you and says, oh, I want like a rye sourdough with some raisins in it or whatever.
We're talking about schools.
And
not
you
bread.
and so you articulate for your, what's your daughter's name?
Sarah.
You articulate that you want Sarah to be challenged, mm-hmm. to be supported at the level that she deserves. That person takes your $10, you get a rock hard piece of bread, no salt, tastes like crap. They're down the road, 50 miles away, and you and Sarah are like what's happening in Florida. You were full of hopes and dreams, which you should be, for your outcomes, for her outcome, she's excited, and by the third week, the education is horrible. Now what? You've paid the bill, and they're gone.
I think we would be having a very different conversation if there was more regulation and transparency in this legislation. Like, right now, the rule is you get $5,000 to go do whatever you want with your kid. If you want to start a school of life and go do whatever you want, if you want to teach Marxist ideals, if you want to teach, you can do whatever you want with that money, right? And what we're getting at is, with so many choices, the majority of parents don't have the education, the time, or the patience to wade through all of those things. And in the meantime, our public schools still do have those standards that they have to meet and that accountability that they have to meet. And what we end up developing is two competing systems, neither of which can be fully funded using taxpayer dollars.
So my proof on this is, why are we meeting here versus at the middle school? This is a private building, private place, that is much better facility than the public schools.
I'll tell you why. Because at the middle school right now, there's homeschoolers, there's private schoolers, there's middle school kids. They're all in the gym. There's 60 of them. My daughter, I think, maybe is still there. I don't know what time it is. That's why. There's one gym. In Sandpoint Middle School, we have one gymnasium. It's being used right now by the entire public. Okay.
All right, thank you.
Come up to the microphone so that everyone can hear you. Thank you for coming up.
I wanted to make a point about what he said.
Yeah.
What you implied was that no child in public education gets the education they deserve. I want to disagree with you. I have a friend, she's in 10th grade now. I get the freshman, senior, sophomore, I get them confused. In 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th. In 9th grade, she was doing 11th grade math. She did geometry over the summer, she pushed herself. There's 400 kids at the middle school. The teachers cannot prioritize one student over another. That is up to the student themselves. I had a teacher, Miss Warwick. She was amazing. She is amazing. But the teachers also have to teach at the lowest level. I have to push myself in English. I have to push myself in math. I have to push myself in science. The teacher cannot do that for them. Your daughter may be young, but that's still something she has to learn to do.
Thank you. If you drive a gray Toyota Prius with the license plate 7B318 4U, your lights are on and you will probably not have an easy ride home. So if you are a gray Toyota Prius.
Yes, I know. She was moving.
That's all.
All right, I'll be pretty quick with my question. My name's Jeremiah. I'll be pretty quick with my question. I'm hearing a lot of interesting information coming out with the online ed options, the tech stuff. I don't totally dismiss it, but let's be real, most of that's in the college monies, at least as of now. And will it filter? Yeah, it's already filtering in some ways. But I'm not super worried about that. I do hear the play is to grab that money and go. Yeah, probably true. A lot of people grab money and go when they can. I'm actually more interested in what this does competitively. I see this as a play against the unions that have really caused harm in some ways to the public educational system. So I would love to hear your thoughts and opinions about, because those are real. I've been in school districts before, and sometimes they cause some difficulties. And so I'd love to hear from the panel, what harms have you seen that have been caused by the unions, and how do we fix those so that I can get on board with what you all are talking about?
If you'd stay at the microphone, just in case we have return.
Yeah, sure.
For example, I have just a quick, a back question. Who sets the curriculum for your school district?
Great question. I'll answer that question after my questions are answered.
Okay, well, I just want to clarify.
Because I see the style.
I'm asking, do you know who sets the curriculum?
Who sets the curriculum? I'll come back to that.
Okay.
I'll write it down.
Go ahead.
I have to say we have an amazing relationship with our association, but I also have a leadership team that's been consistent for the last 4 years, a 90% retention rate of our instructors. And we just set a high expectation. And we said that if you want to work in Boundary County School District, this is who Boundary County School District is. And if you can't support that, then you need to get off our bus. It was a consistent, loud message that we just said on opening day. But we are making that progress. We're clear in our policies. We're clear in our procedures. And we go through many steps with the support of our association. So we are not seeing the problems that you're talking about right now. I don't know.
So there's no problems with the way that the union works within any of the school districts?
I can give you an example. There was discussion saying, you know what, I don't want to stay for a staff meeting. Guess what? We went to our association, and I said to our association negotiator, I said, if we don't agree to be part of this team, if we don't agree to attend our staff meetings, then I'm going to ask our board of trustees to not sign our negotiated agreement. We will work with you, but we are here for kids first. Our kids are worth whatever it takes. So I'm not sure what you're hearing out there. We have a very positive relationship. We work hard, and it's shown in our student achievement. For the last 3 years, we've been in the top 10, and not top percent, but top 10 of reading growth in the state. We outperform in 17 to 20 areas on the ISAT. We hold our teachers accountable, but you know what? They're there for the kids. So I'm not sure where you're hearing that or where you're coming from. I could not tell you, but I'd say in North Idaho, we're communities and we work together.
Kim, did you have a response as well?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that question too. I was a principal at the middle school for 15 years. I never had an issue. And you know, because I think really they're negotiating basically wages. It really doesn't affect the classroom, what we were doing. We had distributed leadership teams, so we worked as a team to improve schools. At first, teachers just volunteered their time. You know, we were at the end of the year, I would take them out to lunch at some place in town. Yeah, but that's about all they got for it. That's the kind of dedication I see. You see them way before they're supposed to be there. You see them way after they're supposed to be. I see us. You got a teacher sitting really close to you. I don't know when she got up because I left before she left. But, you know, it was really hard, you know. But, teachers want boundaries like everybody else. And so they don't really read the associate. They don't really talk to you. You're going to have an associated member or something like that. They don't really talk to you. So I've been in every school, in Boundary and in Bonner County, and I just don't see it's an issue. I don't hear that. And I do get there's a national thing again. You know, there's a strong teachers unions at the national level. We hear about and read about those sorts of things. Again, this is rural Idaho. I don't see that. We're not a big city. And here's the funny thing, the pot's only so big. Mm-hmm. The state's got a little funny formula. So there isn't a whole lot to negotiate. But, we want them on our curriculum committees. We also have our parents on our curriculum committees. We have students. We want to involve as many people. And I think that's what we look at. Let's involve people and make decisions for schools that's going to benefit kids, bottom line. So, I'm sorry to hear that, I don't see it.
Okay, anybody else want to comment? Sweet. All right, I'll answer your question. Who sets the curriculum? The state sets the regulations. Underneath the regulations, we then have the opportunity to pick curriculum. That's done typically at the local level obviously, hopefully, some wisdom, not just what the nation is doing. Now, Idaho, we actually do have it really good. We invest the least amount in students in the entire United States per student, the least, the lowest. And we're typically in the top 20 in terms of performance. So we are light years ahead of what other states are dealing with. But I think the play here that I'm getting at is we have certain things that are, I heard words, accountability, regulation, audit. These are all things that often they can be really good sometimes, but more often than not, they impede us in getting the job done, which is spending time with kids. We're doing more documenting and less helping. Now, we have amazing teachers here. I know a bunch of them. So I got nothing bad to say about our teachers in this community at all. And there are still some that, it's 2:21, I gotta go. Like, we see that. It's not very common in our community, but it's all over the place. And my concern is that more people are coming here, and that might bring more of that with them. So we've got to keep our eyes open. Did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you for that answer. I would also just say, I have a hard time believing they wouldn't just go to Washington. My mom lives on the Wyoming border. It's super tempting to cross that border and make double my pay. On my first day, I would make double my pay. So I think we're hard-pressed to get teachers, and it helps us to get the good ones here. Was there another question?
Here to ask a question. I would like to introduce the question about ideology into the discussion. We've stayed away from that. It's a hot topic. People are terrified to talk about it in public. So the specific thing is that the politics of the moment are in part driven by the new apostolic reforms that intend to take over the seven mountains, one of which is education. They are very effective at doing that in general. They're working hard now. And one of the features of that takeover is that a huge amount of outside money is coming in to pay lobbyists to pressure politicians in Boise to pass legislation that fits their religious agenda. I'm a religious man. I'm a Quaker. I go to a meeting every week. I commit to my community. In fact, I volunteer at the library with a lot of smart kids, many of whom are homeschooled. And we're working on learning how to do computer programming. So the issue isn't about what religion they're being taught or about what their orientation is religiously. It's about the fundamental separation of church and state. The fact that religious issues are really important to people and shouldn't be things that are mandated to be taught in school, shouldn't be things that are funded by the public. They should be things which are funded by the people who believe them directly and not as a public concern. So I'm raising that. I'm not sure that you've opened a way to talk about that, but I would guess the question would be more to Elizabeth as the policy person in the background. Are you seeing this religious influence as one of the prime movers in the efforts to get these vouchers out there to fund religious schools with public money?
It's certainly a good question. The thing that I think about, and I'm grateful that you raised this question, the thing that I think about more than anything is not what I'm seeing, because I have to be humble enough to know that what I am seeing, because I hang out in rural Idaho, is all of the multiple points of evidence of what Jan and Kim are talking about that spend a lot more time in the field, right? Which is just really practical, unyielding care for our communities and our kids. And really, to me, that's gives me a ton of hope for the future. From an ideological standpoint, I don't see that in our schools. And, you know, like what happens on Sunday or what happens when somebody is with their, you know, own thoughts is to me some of the beauty of the United States. And like I said, I in my bio, kind of cheekily, but I have hung out outside of the U.S. for a long time and seeing where that can go horribly wrong. From an ideology standpoint, what really worries me more than anything is those that are using that as a marketing tool in ways that are really hollow and harmful, not only to the believers of said ideology, because it's disingenuous, but also because the kids aren't getting the quality that the parent hoped that they were. So it's really the misuse or the branding that worries me more than anything without accountability.
And I would echo, in the Magic Valley and Treasure Valley, we are already beginning to see that creeping in where there are schools popping up, using that as a branding technique. Do we have any other questions from the audience?
Hello, my name is Justin Shuck. I graduated from Sandpoint High School, and I have a middle school child and elementary school child. And one question to start is, do you have to disenroll your student to take advantage of this $5,000 per child?
Yes.
And for how long?
It's like set by the school year. So if you take the $5,000, they're out for that school year. And one of the fuzzy things that we're going to start seeing, I believe, in the next couple of years is if you pull your kid out, put them in a non-accredited school for a year, and then bring them back into the public school system, that's not going to be transferable because we have to put them at grade level. And so the answer is we're too young into this to know, but the short answer is the whole school year. You've got to pull them for the year.
So you would tell my child that he couldn't register for school if I took advantage of the $5,000?
Yeah.
And the mechanism for that is?
Call the tax commission.
So my question is, on a Monday, if I have my children in school, I disenroll them on Tuesday, I take my $5,000, I write the check to the school district, $5,000 each, and show them this is education, investing in your school district, and re-enroll them on a Wednesday. I've taken that money, I've given it back to my school district.
I'd say call the tax commission, but you don't get to do the money thing until you file your taxes, so we should have this conversation in January.
You know,
do you see my point? Or my
question? Yeah,
I do, and I think you had an idea. Do that April 14th, and then April 16th, get your credit April 16th to re-enroll them. That's a good idea.
Yeah, yeah.
I never thought of that. Another one of the little loopholes.
Hi, my name's Evan. I've got four kids currently in homeschool. The thing that I'm trying to understand from a numbers perspective, you said it's $9,000 per child per year? When I can pay $3,600 for four of my kids to actually have schooling for a year, that math doesn't math to me. And when you're talking about also like the inflation rates that we're talking about with having schools and we have with desks and actually keeping the lights on and keeping the school districts there, I mean, that's definitely a difficult problem. But when I think about the overhead that's involved with public schools versus what I can do with a homeschool and that I have a much better education for my kids, I've got one that has an IEP, has very special needs, and she has thrived in homeschooling versus public school. And currently, right now, my problem is that I get zero of my tax dollars back. So when I'm thinking about a number of $3,600 per year, and my kids get a better education, and you're talking about $9,000 per year per kid, that math doesn't math to me. So help me understand what would be the reason why I could do that when we could instead scale down our schools, maybe remove a lot of the administration overhead, because I've also seen charts where we have like, 400% increase, I think, and that might not be in Idaho specifically. Again, I'm actually originally from Texas. I'm not from here in Idaho, so I don't know those numbers exactly. But when I see the administrative costs actually increase by about 400% on the number of people that we're actually bringing in to work in administration and not necessarily as teachers, it makes me think instead of putting more money towards a system that seems actually pretty ineffective on the amount of money that we're spending and the money that I'm not getting back, that I'm actually putting taxes into, it just doesn't seem like that's sustainable long-term when we could instead scale down on the amount of schools that we have, actually go to smaller communities and smaller schools to where kids would actually get a much better education. Because if you have a school with one teacher and five kids in that class, and we have more of those little small communities, I would then know all five of those students in that class and make sure that they get the proper education that they need.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. But you're a very involved, dedicated parent. Mm-hmm. Where I live and work in a system that's not the case. Mm-hmm. We have significant poverty where parents aren't able to do that. Mm-hmm. So we have to, our Constitution says, a free, public, uniform, thorough educational system. And we're not opposed at all for parents to have choice or for parents to receive funds, but not at the expense of a state that doesn't properly fund public education right now. So if we're going to do that, then fully fund public education and then decide where we can go from there. Right now, Boundary County School District spends $1.7 million on special education that's not funded. That has to come from somewhere, so it comes from our supplemental levy. So yes, it does cost us quite a bit of money. Like I talked about the busing for, between those two things, we probably wouldn't have to run a levy if they were fully funded. But I'm also up here advocating for every child that doesn't have a family that can provide that you're providing. So even though you sound like you're doing an amazing job, there's no comparative measure. You stand there and say they're getting a better education, and I'm gonna believe you. I'm gonna trust you that that's happening. But they don't. You don't have the same accountability measures that we have. And until you have the same accountability measures, or every school has those same accountability measures, it's not an equal playing field.
Yeah,
so it costs you less to do because you don't have those expectations.
Sure, but that doesn't sound like because.
Can I ask you a clarifying question about
your
3,600?
Yes.
Sorry to interrupt.
No, it's fine.
Just,
go ahead.
My brain's kind of stuck on it.
Mm-hmm.
Are you including the cost of, you know, your transportation, your facility of your home, your home maintenance, your heat?
I think probably in total that would be about $5,200 per year.
Yeah, because I mean, I think that's the thing
for
that
four
often,
kids. Just FYI,
we think about like in general, and I know like the MO of awesome folks in North Idaho is to like get her done with a lot less,
sure.
And that's why I love this place, right? But the reality is that like 9,000 oftentimes goes to things like heat
and food
and in fixed. No, that's
not
okay. You know, like it's legitimately things that are, you know, oil changes on the bus, things like that. So I was just curious if in your $3,600 a year, are you including your car oil change and your air filters or your heating cost or things like that? I was just curious.
Well, no, not exactly. I mean, it's $3,600 for curriculum and actually sending them to a homeschool co-op is what we're paying for right now. But I mean, even in that number, if I was to estimate what we spend on that, it'd probably be about $5,000 for the year total. We don't spend that much on our car maintenance and everything else too. And the other problem that I have also is foods and other school that are going into school districts too. It's not exact. I mean, if we're talking about a holistic perspective on the student and making sure that they're getting the best education, best health, best environment that they could possibly grow up in, we could do it in a smaller scale. With individual parents, again, you're talking about poverty level parents, and I feel for them. If we banded together in smaller pockets to be able to make that work, we could do it cheaper. And it doesn't make sense to me on the amount of money that's being spent in that to actually make that work. I understand rural is also difficult, but in any case.
Sorry, it's been.
No, it's fine. I know I've been talking a lot.
I know.
Sorry.
I'm just watching the clock. We have time for one more question.
Cool.
So we're going to go ahead, question or comment, and then. Okay. We should have put you on the panel.
I know friends who show up to school at 6:35 in the morning because they live too far out of town to bike in, and their parents have to get to work at that time. I know friends who they have to rely on the school for the breakfast and the lunch that they eat in the morning. They don't have the money. I don't think you understand, like, how bad some of these kids' situations are. It's real, and it's like, you talk as if parents have time. They have the same amount of time as you do. Neither of my parents have that time. And I can no longer be homeschooled by my aunt. I mean, I was homeschooled by 3 years. I have the perspective of somebody who was homeschooled. But it's, I wouldn't say it was better than what I'm getting right now. And I'll restate it again. That's because I am pushing myself in the school system. It's, how do I phrase this? There's a lot of stuff you're not taking into account that really just throws it off. I mean, I haven't always lived in Sandpoint. I used to live in Washington. We had a much larger school, 4 classrooms per grade. Massive, massive school. And it looked way better than SMS. It had better funding. It had more, it had more after school activities. My brother could do chess club. We had a functional library. It was better. And I don't think you'd be making the same argument if your child or if we lived in Washington, because our school system is underfunded. It is completely and totally underfunded because the school system has to support these kids in more ways than just education. That's all I'm going to say.
I've got to say, that's the kind of leadership we want.
Okay, and on that awesome note, we would like to invite Senator Jim Woodward and Representative Mark Sauter up for a few minutes. Both of them would like to discuss their votes on HB 93. Oh, sorry, we were...
Do we have time for another question or not?
Yeah, we had time for one more question. We had time. We took the statement.
Okay.
So let's let them, and then if we have time at the end of that, we'll let you go, okay? And now I've lost them.
It's been a while since I've been on a microphone. Thanks for coming out this evening. I want to start quickly with a success story. I think a lot of us are familiar with Farragut and the old picture of the hospital being barged up the lake to Sandpoint for reuse. We also saw that some of those materials went up to Bonner's Ferry were used in building Valley View Elementary. And so there was a $50 million success story this year. And we have to give credit to Superintendent Baer and Trustee Teresa Ray in the work they've done diligently to pursue replacing Valley View Elementary, which was, I always say, was old when I started there in 1977. And they were awarded a grant this year that, along with some of the money from last year, Valley View Elementary will be replaced starting
in May.
So we're pretty happy about that. That does stand in contrast, that some of those programs and improvements we made stand in contrast to what I think that we're stepping backward a little bit with jumping into the voucher system in the state of Idaho. And I say that because we have to look first at what our initial our minimum obligations are. Those are outlined in the Idaho Constitution, and that's providing that public system of education. We would like to educate all of the children in the state, but our forefathers set in place this system where we said we're going to make sure that those who would otherwise not receive an education do. And that's what the public system is doing. That creates community and a sense of belonging in the state. That is not to take away at all from what some parents do. And we've seen some great success stories with homeschooling and the other options. But if we have to prioritize the money, then we have to make sure that public education system gets taken care of. And that's been the real challenge. And we'll see that in our upcoming budget cycle. I guess I would emphasize that point about that $50 million, which is a tax credit. So that's before the money's hitting the front door of the Capitol. It's already gone away at the tax commission. So we're not going to see that in the budget process. It makes it a little bit tougher. And I'd point out that that's the only tax credit I know of that has a cap on it. So we saw that cap put in at $50 million, and I think that made the legislation more palatable, but that cap will be challenged. If it's not removed by the legislature, then that cap will be challenged in court, I believe, so that the cap is removed. And that's where it'll be hard to track. And you've heard from one of the panelists here a few times this evening about the notion of the education system and the vendors, how this plays out as a legislator. When you see that vendor come through the door in the Capitol, they have a product to sell. And so they hire a lobbyist, and then they influence decisions in the Capitol so that to get the preferred outcome of their product being used. That is a reality. And just a simple example of that is right now all high school students take the SAT. When we pay for that as a state, that all students take the SAT. Now, if you put forth, as a legislator, if you come forward with the idea that, hey, we really want to cater these the education to the student. And so some kids might want to take the SAT because they want to go to college. Some kids might want to take the ASVAB because they really think they want to head off to a military career. Or there might be some other test we could use and so that they could get into a career technical program or whatever that path is. But, well, as a legislator, if you put that up, there's a company out there that is being paid right now under contract to provide an SAT for all of the students in the public education system. And if you cut that in half, their income gets cut in half. If the other students are taking other tests, they're not going to see that. So do they have a vested interest in maintaining that all students take the SAT, and so then is it hard to get the votes to remove that requirement? That's the kind of thing we're talking about when you look at those details. That's just one. So I guess just to conclude, you know, really back on that constitutional requirement, that is why how I landed on my vote, that I didn't support House Bill 93 this year, because I think that we need to continue to make the improvement. We have made great strides in the last 7-8 years in funding in the state, and we're shifting that paradigm. The state has never paid for facilities. We're getting past that. That's a big deal, and it's even a bigger deal for one of our local communities here in Boundary County School District. But look at that, 4 minutes and 59 seconds. Not bad, huh?
Not sure. I won't time it. I'll try and be succinct. I voted no for a number of reasons. A lot of those have already been touched on. I think our primary duty as representatives for all of you is to vote for our district and vote for our state. I looked at House Bill 93 as a real tax shift. All through my three sessions, I've been extremely supportive of education. I talked to Jan, and I think I'm an ed supporter. But I also looked at it from just pure taxation. I just didn't think it was right that we would shift $50 million to it was estimated that somewhere between 7% and 10% of our families may benefit from. When I go out door knock, or I meet people on the street, or I go someplace and meet people, the number one thing we talk about is property tax. And I looked at it and said, why are we not just shifting $50 million to everybody's property tax? Because I thought that would be a better way to shift it across the board rather than really give it to a very small group of people, a small group of families. I just didn't think it was right. I thought we could use that money better if we used it in different ways. I also didn't like the idea that the bill sets up a list of those that want that tax credit. Some of those tax credits will get filled. It's anticipated that many will not. But we'll have a shopping list to come back. We won't, I won't, but the tax commission will, and say, well, hey, we still have a request for another $50 million or 100, whatever it may be, but it's queued up to where it really builds on anticipation for the next time and the next time. And I wasn't comfortable with that. Another part of it is, I think it's a first-come, first-served system. So for those that want the tax credit, they'll need to do their taxes early and get them in quickly. But the majority of people that do their taxes in April. I'm probably one of them. So it really kind of changed the game. And I was concerned that there was potentially some gaming and that it would be difficult for families that needed the tax credit, but may not be in a position to get to file for it right away. So that didn't really seem fair to me either. Plus all the other education takeaways. And then when we had problems in West Bonner years ago, I think they lost about 10% of their student body. They moved. They talked about school choice, and I appreciate Kim's answers, and he's absolutely right. But in Idaho, you can also move districts. So we had a number of kids from West Bonner come over to Sandpoint. And heaven knows where those other good choices that their parents made and that they went. But regardless, there's lots of school choices across districts as well. So I just thought, for a myriad of reasons, I couldn't bring myself to vote for 93. So I think there's got to be better ways for us to support public education and for school choice. I know there's good choices ahead of us, but we have to vote no sometimes. And this was one that it wasn't that hard for me to push the button. So I thank you for your support, and I thank you all for being here in support of our schools and with questions, good hard questions for our schools as well. They're a public entity, and I'm a representative for all of you. So I'm due those as well. So that's the way our system should work. But I think a number of you are here to support public education, and I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you to these two legislators. Just as a reminder, the primaries in Idaho matter a lot, and we have seen across the board those being leveraged to get people to vote in certain directions at the Capitol. So make sure that you go out in May and make sure that your votes are there to support legislators that are making votes the way that you would like those votes to be made. Talk with your legislators. When it comes to legislation, they are the key to deciding if this is a $50 million bill or a $300 million bill going into the next legislative session. So keep in touch with your state legislators. With that, we would like to give each of our panelists just a couple of short minutes to give their closing statements. Rock, paper, scissors.
I'm going to go and get it done with. That's what I'm going to do. No, I just want to thank all of you for coming out. If you have any questions, please feel free to stay afterwards. We'll mingle for a little bit. I just want to say I'm a big supporter of public education. My children graduated from Bonners Ferry High School and are very successful at college right now. But we also serve the diverse needs. And Senator Woodward, thank you for saying that. Sometimes we have mandates in public education that really don't fit all kids, and we are working really, really hard for all students right now to come up with pathways for each child to be successful. So if you have other ideas, we'll welcome those. Senator Woodward and Representative Sauter have been there for us. We can call them, we can talk to them, and we truly believe our kids are worth whatever it takes, so we're going to continue to fight for them. Thank you.
So very briefly, I said I would talk about Florida, so I'll talk about Florida in my closing remarks. $3.8 billion. That's our taxpayer deal. We've got $50 million in tax, right? $3.8 billion. Now, Florida and Idaho are not the same. I get that. Fine. But the reality is that it grows. What also grows there is the amount of people that would like to get a piece of that $3.8 billion. We have a choice in Idaho. The good news is we're not the first people to do this. The good news is we have some really tangible examples about how it's not working. Florida is one of the ones that's ahead of this curve of doing this thing that House Bill 93 is doing, or potentially doing. People are trying to get a handle on accountability in Florida right now. It's kind of a newer thing, but they're trying to measure growth. So for every student that's gonna get these dollars in Florida, their little piece of $3.8 billion, they're trying to understand, are they growing? Are they learning, basically? They're having a really hard time figuring that out. Why? Because that means you have to have year one and a year two in the same school. So that is an interesting thing that's playing out in the data right now. They're having an extremely hard time figuring out the difference between year one and year two because people are switching schools. Why are they switching schools?
anybody that's ever had to switch a school for their kid or an educational system for their kid knows it's not an easy thing to do. It's not something that people take lightly. They're doing it because it's not working for them. Again, more choice does not equal more quality.
Thanks. I want to thank the panelists and all of us getting together tonight. I still want a big shout out for our middle school girl. Can we give a big round for her? Well, that's something we be proud of. I do appreciate everybody coming. And you know, I didn't start in education. When I left college. That was the last thing I was ever thinking I was ever going to get into. Having an opportunity to coach sports. I started coaching youth sports, and I realized, hey, I like being around kids, and you know, it's kind of fun. So then got into teaching, and I just love being a teacher. One thing I saw when I was a teacher, though, I didn't think I was from this community, and I wanted to have the best school in the state. That was my thinking, because we deserve the best, and we're just because we're a rural school, we can compete against anybody, and. Couple people know this, we became the highest performing middle school, Sandpoint Middle School, in the state of Idaho. And the reason we did is because teachers cared. They worked hard. They cared about kids. Everything, our entire focus was about kids. I've been traveling around North Idaho, working with all sorts of districts. I see the same thing. We don't know what we don't know. We are underfunded, but we can have great achievements if we work together, if we stay as a community. And that's what matters. Thanks a lot for coming up.
Okay, we'd like to thank our panelists. And as we've talked about tonight, the conversations that we've had are leading us into this next legislative session, which can determine whether this program is expanded or if it's stopped. One way you can share your opposition, if you have that, is to sign the Not $1 More petition. I believe we have people with those in the back of the room. Our partner, Reclaim Idaho, is supporting a petition with the aim of getting at least 1,000 signatures in each legislative district to make sure that our lawmakers understand that we don't want to see the $50 million program expand. You can sign at a table near the door and find out how you can help and spread the word. Most of us up on the stage are planning to stick around if there's questions or you would like to continue conversations. Thank you for your time, and everyone have a lovely Thursday evening. Thank you.